Bon dia. Benvinguts i benvingudes a la tercera sessió i darrera de la jornada anual de l'Observatori dels Públics del Patrimoni Cultural de Catalunya. La sessió d'avui girarà al voltant de com escoltar i connectar amb els públics en temps de distància social. I per parlar d'això, comencem amb la participació de la Marie Hobson, que ens presentarà un cas molt interessant d'aplicació de tècniques qualitatives per escoltar els públics. La Maria és la responsable de l'àrea d'estudis de públics i advocacy del Museu d'Història Natural de Londres i dirigeix l'equip de recerca de públics. Actualment està fent el seu doctorat al King's College de Londres. I la seva tesi explora com la investigació del públic pot ajudar els museus a convertir-se en organitzacions d'aprenentatge per suportar aquesta i futures crisis. Li hem demanat a la Mari que ens expliqui la seva experiència en matèria de focus groups online, que és una tècnica que permet recollir dades menys fredes que les mètriques que ens proporciona Google Analytics o les enquestes en línia. Només comentar-vos que si voleu seguir aquesta presentació de la Mari en traducció simultània al català, trobareu a sota de la vostra pantalla una icona que diu interpretació o interpretation. Només cal que seleccioneu el canal Spanish i que desactiveu el so de la versió original si no la teniu desactivada ja, per evitar possibles interferències. D'altra banda, aprofito també per convidar-vos a deixar les vostres preguntes per als ponents al llarg de tot el matí, al xat o a la part de preguntes i respostes. Mari, quan vulguis.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Marie Hobson, and I'm the Audience Research and Insight Manager at the Natural History Museum in London in the UK. There, I manage a team of visitor researchers who work across our exhibitions and learning programmes. During the pandemic, I set up the COVIDsitor Twitter handle you can see on this slide to try and help audience researchers and museums and science centres understand the new methods that were emerging in terms of audience research through the pandemic, as well as the findings from them. So I'm delighted to be here to share this with you. When the world headed into lockdown as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, audience researchers were no longer able to conduct focus groups face to face, so quickly pivoted to using this method online. However, running focus groups online is not as straightforward as simply transferring an in-person focus group to a digital platform. It comes with its own pros and cons and requires very different ways of working. So my talk has two parts. Firstly, I will talk about our research project, what we found out and what we're going to do to implement the findings. And secondly, I'll talk about what we have learned about running focus groups online. The Natural History Museum in London is surrounded by 5 acres of gardens and grounds. Although part of the site is taken up with a wildlife garden, much of the area is quite bare and unengaging. Very few visitors spend time in our gardens, other than to have a picnic and to let their children run round. Through the Urban Nature Project, we want to transform our gardens into a more welcoming, accessible, and biologically diverse green space in the heart of London. New outdoor galleries, such as the one in this picture, will showcase the museum's scientific research and provide a place for the public to enjoy and explore urban nature. The existing wildlife garden will be extended to double the area of native habitats within the grounds, providing a fabulous setting for our historic building. This is really important because over 80% of the UK population live in urban areas, and this is projected to rise to 92% by 2030, leading to more challenges for wildlife as they compete for space with their human neighbours. It means towns and cities are rapidly becoming the place where most people will experience nature and are therefore key places to be able to protect the UK's biodiversity. One of the main target audiences for the Urban Nature Project is families with children aged 8 to 12. This is our core audience. Before the pandemic, families made up around half of our annual visitorship. However, the demographics of these families didn't reflect the demographics of our three most local boroughs, our most local area, in terms of ethnicity, socioeconomic status, or disability. Therefore, through the Urban Nature Project, we want to diversify this core audience to better reflect and include the families from our local area who are from lower socioeconomic backgrounds and more likely to be from an ethnic minority background. While the museum has a lot of audience research regarding its visitors and families, we've identified gaps in our knowledge with regard to these families who live more locally, who are from these demographic groups, particularly in regard to how they connect to nature. In January 2020, the museum launched a new strategy with a mission to create advocates for the planet. By an advocate, we mean someone who will speak up on behalf of nature and take action. To accompany the strategy, the museum also created an advocate engagement model, which you can see on the screen. This is a framework for the museum to help create those advocates. Designed to be implemented through all forms of our engagement, our learning programs, our exhibitions, our events, it's based on our evaluations and a literature review. And the model says that first, we need to inspire people. We need to create a connection to nature so that they care about its future. We then need to inform them about the impact that humans have on the planet, both positively and negatively. And finally, we need to empower people. We need to give them the motivation, the confidence, and the opportunities to be able to take positive action on behalf of nature. These are the things we wanted to explore through our online focus groups with this particular audience. We were really keen to understand the audience's connection to the natural world, understand to what extent they understand their role within nature and their impact on it, and finally, to what extent they act on behalf of nature. Here is a summary of the topic guide we used in those focus groups. And you can see that the questions are divided into the three key elements of the model. So inspiration, how did families engage with nature? Inform, how knowledgeable about nature are they? What do they want to know more about? And empower, what are they doing to help nature and what stops them doing more? At the bottom, you can see a diagram of different ways in which people connect with nature. We asked our families to select which of these they felt best represented them and to explain why they made that choice. What was really interesting in this focus group is we realised that connection to nature is a term we talk a lot about at the museum, but isn't really one that's so familiar to the public audience. And actually, they really struggled to answer this question. And the diagram that they picked didn't necessarily reflect the answers they gave, which is an interesting finding in and of itself. On a practical level, we ran three focus groups on Microsoft Teams. We had a total of 15 parents involved, approximately 5 per focus group. And we gave each participant a £40 High Street voucher. We wanted to give our families some sort of thank you through the form of remuneration that could be used at a range of different shops, including supermarkets, recognising that this focus group was a big time commitment on their behalf. And also we were contacting them at a time of quite difficult circumstances where they may not have as much money as normal. We chose a High Street voucher that could be used both for online shopping and face-to-face shopping given COVID restrictions. And we didn't give them cash, which would have been in many ways preferable, because this could have affected the benefits that they get from government, because it would be considered as income. As this was a new audience for us, we recruited them via community gatekeepers. So these are leaders that run community organisations with the local area. So they would be recruited via someone they had a more familiarity with. And through this relationship, we could start building connections to those community organisations, which we felt would help us throughout the project, not just for these focus groups. So what did we find out? Well, in terms of inspiration, families said that they visited green space weekly, usually in the form of a local park. They would do this with their children to enable them to get some fresh air and to be active. Many of the parents we spoke to lived in quite confined accommodation without any gardens or balconies of their own. They viewed the outdoors as a chance to stretch their legs and get some oxygen, particularly during lockdown. And they recognised that this had a positive impact on their well-being. Families visited their local park regularly because they were seen as a quick and easy activity. It didn't require too much effort or pre-planning. Parents could quickly take their children to the park if they were getting bored or restless or required a change of scene. These parks were normally in walking distance and free to enter, making them a preferred option for families. Parents also explained that parks are somewhere that all of the family can enjoy, regardless of their age, particularly because parks could also be used for social opportunities. They could meet up with other families to play games together or to have social occasions like picnics and barbecues. The children could play together while the adults caught up. Some of the barriers to spending more time in these places were weather dependent, the accessibility, cost and time, which is why they stuck traditionally to their local park. What was most interesting for us, though, is that they were not associating their local park with actual nature-based activities or with anything educational. They simply saw it as a place for their children to run around, play sports, and have a social experience. They were not conducting anything that we would call a nature-based activities, for example, collecting leaves, looking for mini beasts, that sort of thing. And the reason that families didn't do more of those activities seemed to be a lack of awareness on the part of parents, as well as their own self-confessed fear of insects. In terms of informing, families also had very little knowledge about the nature on their doorstep. They simply didn't perceive their local park as having nature really in it. And if they did, they were not familiar with sort of the names of trees or plants or species. So there was a real lack of understanding on behalf of the families. When we asked, were they interested in finding out more? They were not interested in finding out more about the species in the area or the nature in the area. They were interested in finding out more about what they could do with their children in that space. So what activities and workshops could their children join? Not finding out anything about the biodiversity. And this was partly a lack of interest on the behalf of the parent, and also what they said was, again, self-confessed laziness. They weren't particularly interested as parents in finding out more about the nature on their doorstep. And finally, in terms of empowering, while many of the participants recognised that humans were having an impact on the environment, it tended to be about impacts humans were having on their local area in terms of economics and housing. So, for example, one participant talked about the housing epidemic in London, the fact that there aren't enough houses for people. Other people talked about the fact they're losing green spaces due to the construction of new living accommodation. So these were the sorts of environmental issues that came most to mind from our participants, things that really affected their daily lives rather than more global issues facing the natural world. The barriers to parents thinking more about these issues or taking more action was really this feeling that they were overwhelmed about by the amount of information about these issues, as well as the complicated science behind them. And this caused them to just turn off. They didn't really want to think about them too much, and they had other concerns, particularly during the pandemic. While many of them did act in ways to help protect the natural world, these tended to be quite small individual actions that didn't really impact too much upon their lifestyle. So things like recycling, turning off light bulbs, that sort of thing. They didn't really want to take any further action that would require more effort or substantial changes to their lifestyle. So for example, eating less meat or stopping flying away on holiday. What did we do with this information? Well, really, we've realized we need to repackage local area. We need to help families and parents actually recognize that there's a wealth of biodiversity in their local green space and understand and recognize that this is somewhere where they can conduct nature-based activities. They do not need to wait for organizations such as the Natural History Museum to offer specific workshops. They themselves can do nature-based activities with their children. And also reverse the negative stigma around insects and try and encourage more interaction with mini beasts. One of the ways that we have tried to do this recently in the Urban Nature Project is we've co-created a trail with some of these local families that's all based around insects and mini beasts. Here we're encouraging families who pick up this trail to explore our wildlife garden, to look at what's underneath their feet in various different habitats within the garden, to save this family here who have been turned into insects. We thought that by creating a trail that's got a story attached to it and is created by families like themselves, we might be able to help families engage a little bit more with the wildlife around them. We also need to reframe nature-based activities, really shift this perception that these are exclusively for educational organisations and that families can do this themselves. One of the ways we've tried to do this is through our Nature Noughts app. This is an app that families can download for free and you help their children conduct a range of nature-based activities just using their phone and whatever green space they have around them. So for example, our colour hunt here is helping children to find different colours that match ones on the app as a kind of scavenger hunt. We're hoping that this helps people engage with the nature around them and see how biodiverse their local area is in quite an easy way. It simply involves a phone and usually taking photographs. It's a playful way of helping children engage with their local area and hopefully then with their parents in terms of nature-based conversations. Information about the species, for example, our tree safari, is contained within the app, so it doesn't rely on parental knowledge. And in terms of environmental related behaviours, how can we encourage families to take more positive action? Well, here on our website, we've created a What You Can Do to Help the Planet guide. We have outlined a number of steps that people can take to take positive action. They've got broad themes such as eating sustainably, energy use, protecting wildlife, but we've also given really specific actions as well, such as eating in season and batch cooking, letting their lawn grow, those sorts of really practical actions. So in this section, I've shared our really specific findings and recommendations from our focus groups. But really what I want to emphasise is how important it is to conduct audience research and not make assumptions about our audience. We'd looked at surveys that had suggested that families spent time on a weekly basis in their local park. We thought that meant that they were spending time connecting with nature and having nature-based experiences. But our focus group showed that this was far from the truth. And it was only through conducting these focus groups that we discovered that. So now I'm going to talk more about an online focus group method and our top tips for how to conduct them. To just make sure we're all on the same page, by a focus group, I mean a group discussion where we unpick a topic in a conversational fashion. It's a really in-depth qualitative method that is designed to understand the differences and the ranges of opinions within a group. So here are my top tips. Prior to the focus group, make sure that you have two different facilitators with clearly defined roles. There is a lot to manage during an online focus group. You need to be watching the chat. You need to be noticing any audience reactions, people putting their hands up, any kind of verbal cues. You need to be assessing who might be wanting to speak next. And if you're screen sharing, you often can't see the chat function. It's really difficult to do all of that on top of actually asking the questions and ensuring that everyone has contributed. If participants have tech issues, it's really important that somebody else is able to address those and work with that participant without disrupting the focus group. And indeed, if you have technological issues, you've got someone who can take over. Have a practice. Make sure that each person, each facilitator is familiar with the technology and their role. Practice screen sharing, using breakout rooms, using the whiteboards, whatever functionality you're using. Create a focused, streamlined topic guide. The time seems to go so much quicker during online focus groups than face-to-face, and it is much slower to get through the material. With people muting, unmuting, the technical issues, interruptions from dogs and cats, it just takes far longer to get people to go through the material. So you really need to be focused. What is the aim? What is it you absolutely have to find out and really stick to that? We ran a focus group with teachers just last week. We asked about three things. We asked about how they did outdoor learning, how they teach environmental issues, and how what they would want from a teacher training course from us. We should not have talked about all three issues in one focus group as we would have done normally. We should have probably stuck to just one topic per focus group. We did not get through all of the material to the depth and the quality we would have liked. So be streamlined and keep it short. Video calling is super intense. Try to keep the discussion to an hour tops any longer, and do make sure you input a break after about 40, 45 minutes. And help your participants prepare. If, like me, they've lost track of what day it is during this pandemic, remind them the focus group is taking place and ask them to join about 5 minutes early. So you can just make sure that there are no technological issues. They can hear you, you can hear them, that sort of thing. In terms of safeguarding, it is really important that your participants have a name that you can use to refer to them. You don't want to be calling people iPad and iPhone. So get people to log in with a name, but this doesn't have to be their real name if they'd rather not. They can use a pseudonym or an avatar. Allow people to turn their video off. While it would be fantastic if you could see everybody's reactions and use that as additional data, some people are going to feel uncomfortable that you're seeing inside their home. Perhaps they've got children who they don't want to be on screen, and maybe they just feel more comfortable speaking with the camera off. So allow that to be optional. If you want to take screenshots or you want to record the session, of course, make it clear exactly what it is you're recording. Is it the video? Is it the voice? Is it the chat? Is it all of them? And how that's going to be used, stored, and disposed of, so people can make an informed decision about whether or not to take part. And also be aware about what is in your background. Maybe use a virtual background or blur your background if you don't want people to be seeing in your house either. At the start of your focus group, make sure you introduce the platform that you're using, as well as any kinds of rules around the focus group itself. While it may seem we've spent all of 2020 on virtual calls, there are a range of different platforms out there, and some of your participants will be more tech savvy than others. So introduce the platform. Encourage participants to use the speaker view to reduce any kind of fatigue. Encourage them to look at the camera and to mute their microphones when not speaking. This is probably the biggest problem we've had, is people not muting and getting all of that background noise from children running around and people knocking on the door. Don't be afraid to mute people if you have to, and make it clear why you're doing it. Encourage participants to use the chat to post their comments and their thoughts. That's another way that you can capture rich data and may suit people who aren't so confident perhaps in sharing a group discussion. What you want is a group discussion, and that is far harder on Zoom, as people cannot talk over each other, so people can respond in the chat instead. Allow people to turn off their video if the connection is poor, and as I've mentioned, blur or change their background if that makes them feel more comfortable. You can also get participants to use the reaction buttons, so get people to interact in a range of ways. One of the other advantages of using these sorts of platforms is that there's often accessibility functions built in, so things like captions. So allow people, make people clear that they can use these and how to use these, and that will increase the accessibility. During the focus group itself, make sure everyone has a chance to speak. This is, as I've said, quite difficult in a virtual world. So invite people by name, ask people to put their hand up, either virtually or physically. Try and watch those reactions. Who looks like they're reacting and wanting to speak? Who's going to unmute their mic? Respond to what's in the chat, or use what people call a popcorn method, which is getting participants themselves to nominate the next person to speak. As I've said, have a break. This is intense for both you and the participants, so allow people to have a break and regroup. And mix it up. Many of these virtual platforms have additional functionality that you can make use of, such as polls, such as a whiteboard, such as those diagrams that I showed you earlier. So encourage people to use the range of activities available, as you would face-to-face. In the top right-hand corner, we have a Miro board. This is something that's really fantastic, where you can get people to go in and write sticky notes, and people can respond to diagrams and move things around. It is really great, but I think you have to make sure that the participants who use something like that are much more tech savvy. But there are a range of options out there. What are the advantages of online focus groups? Well, certainly there are many. Firstly, reach. The fact that participants can take part from their home means you are able to include a wider range of people from a greater geographical reach than normal. Normally, when we run our focus groups, we are restricted to our London location. But as a national museum, we are now able to conduct focus groups with people across all of the nations as part of the UK. You can also increase your representation of certain groups who will ordinarily struggle to attend your site, perhaps because they have access mobility needs, perhaps because of the cost involved, or perhaps because they're single parents and can't get a babysitter. As I've mentioned, some platforms have accessibility features built in, and that will help people who are perhaps less fluent in your language or have an access need. They can also do things like turning volumes up and down. So this increases the accessibility for people with additional needs. The ability to turn cameras off and to use the chat will also help people who feel nervous about speaking out in a group setting. Running focus groups online is also a cost-saving measure. In person, you may have to pay for room hire, refreshments, staff to work late, someone to meet and greet the participants. As well as not having to pay for those sorts of things, you may also be able to save costs depending on what platform you're using. For example, our museum already has an account with Microsoft Teams, so we can use that for free. If you use some of the functionality such as captioning, that means you then don't have to pay for transcription costs. You're able to record, you're often able to record the session and also save the chat without any need for additional equipment. Previously, when we ran focus groups and staff wanted to observe them, we had to set up the focus group in one room and a complicated camera video feed to our staff in another room. But now we can record the focus group live and we can send it to our staff members to watch at their leisure at their own time. All of this means that online focus groups are quicker and easier to set up, as there's just less organisation involved. The main thing you need to do is the recruitment and the topic guide. And because of this, it is an easier method and has been a really fantastic one that we have used during the pandemic. It is just less of a hassle than face-to-face. There are also lots of disadvantages of running online focus groups. For example, with the reach, while the online focus groups do broaden reach, they still require participants to have a stable internet connection, access to a device, confidence with the technology, and the time to participate. During the lockdown, it is likely that certain groups, such as health workers or parents who were homeschooling, would still not be able to take part in our focus groups, and we need to recognise that. Not as many people can also take part in the focus group. Face-to-face, we tend to run focus groups with 6 to 8 participants. We found that you can't run online focus groups with more than 5 because it takes so long to get through that material. So then you potentially have to run more online focus groups to get the amount of information that you need. Different people have different levels of experience with the technology that you're using. As I've said, there are so many different platforms out there and different variations on really similar functionality. So you can't assume that people will know or remember how to use your platform. Those who are less familiar with using computers and devices may need help taking part. And indeed, do not assume that everyone will join in from a laptop or a desktop computer. Many use their mobile devices, and the smaller screen may mean they struggle to see the stimulus material or take part in all of the functionality. Internet stability. Internet connections, as I'm sure we've all realised, are not always stable. People may freeze and drop in and out of the call, which is quite disruptive. There are also other distractions as people are taking part from home. Dogs barking, children appearing, people coming to the door. This can distract your participants and again, takes up time. So overall, focus groups are slower online and it is harder to get through that material, which, as I've said, means it is important that you have a short, focused topic guide. There are also fewer opportunities to develop a rapport with your participants, as you don't really have time for small talk that might take place as you're kind of meeting and greeting participants. And if they've got their camera off, it's really hard for you to see and respond to their facial expressions. And of course, as we've mentioned, there are safeguarding issues around seeing into people's homes and them seeing into yours. So in conclusion, I would say we are really grateful and lucky that we've been able to run a lot of online focus groups during this period. But what I've realised is online focus groups, whilst hassle-free in many regards, are not as good as face-to-face focus groups. The whole point of a face-to-face focus group is to get a conversation and a discussion going, people responding to and against what other people are saying. And that is very, very difficult to do in an online setting. It can feel like you are having one-on-one interviews with 5 people as you go around asking them to respond. So for me personally, whilst I would say an online focus group is better than nothing, we will certainly be going back to face-to-face focus groups longer term. As an alternative, what I would recommend is that you conduct in-depth interviews with either one-on-one people or one-on-one family group. We've also done this during this time period, both just on the phone by calling up teachers and having a half an hour chat with them. And we've also done it through Microsoft Teams or Zoom, where you can have a video call with a person and still show stimulus material through slides and so on. And through that, you'd still get that rich, in-depth response to the issue that you are exploring. So here, I hope I've given you the top tips of how to run online focus groups and how to make them as successful as possible, given those caveats. But equally, I would like to recommend that you really consider what is the best way of collecting that data and do consider those in-depth interviews. Thank you. I don't know if there are any questions.
Moltes gràcies, Marie. Sí que n'hi ha unes quantes preguntes. Per exemple, la Irene demana si aquest focus group o normalment els focus groups online al museu els feu directament o per part del personal del museu o contracteu una empresa externa que els realitza. I en aquesta línia demana el pressupost, quin seria el rang de preus. Aquesta seria una primera pregunta. I una segona pregunta és qui prepara els materials per implementar l'activitat al web? L'equip de la comunicació del museu, una agència externa?
Sure. So we're really lucky at the Natural History Museum that we have an audience research team. So there are four of us who this is our full-time job doing audience research. So during COVID, we've run these focus groups ourselves. We've prepared the material with the project team. And we've come up with a topic guide based on what the team wants to know, and we've run and conducted them ourselves. Where we've used external has tended to be with the recruitment of specific family groups, like I said, with the community gatekeepers, or perhaps other families. We also use a recruiter who's got a database of participants. So we've run them ourselves. Having said that, we do also commission out and use external facilitators to run focus groups as well. That can be really helpful if you haven't really got too much time to do it. It can be really helpful if sometimes it's useful to have an external person feeding back to the project team, if it's perhaps a tricky issue or something that you think the project team might not want to hear. So for example, if you're, we did some focus groups to find out what people would want in a meteorites exhibition. We used an external, and I'm very glad, because basically we realized that everyone thinks that meteorites are really boring and dull and didn't really want to go to that exhibition. So I was quite pleased that an external person was saying that. And for some reason, I do find that sometimes external consultants say the same things that I've been saying for months, but because they're external, for some reason, people listen to them more, which is depressing. But so yeah, we've used both. When we do focus groups face to face, the cost, if we go externally, you're looking at I don't know the conversion, around £2,000 to £2,500 per focus group, because of the refreshments, the room hire, the cost of the external facilitator. When we run them in-house, you're more looking at like £100, something like that, because we mainly just pay for refreshments and incentives and maybe transcription. Online, the costs are far reduced. So we paid an incentive, so that was the £40. We pay for transcription costs. That's like £1 a minute, but that's about it. So they are certainly cheaper. And so in terms of preparing the material, I sort of touched on it. It's we do it in collaboration with the project team. So we really try to understand what it is they want to know and why they want to know it. We also have our own questions that we might be interested in as well, particularly as we find a lot of people don't really know what it is they want to know from the audiences. So we will craft a topic guide kind of in collaboration with them, but we are better placed knowing how to ask the questions in a way that isn't biased or leading and that sort of thing. But then we would go back to the project team and say, you know, we need a photo of this, or can you write a text label or that sort of thing? So they prepare the stimulus material for us. But we think about, yeah, what are the best ways of presenting that information, asking the questions, you know, for example, where I've said, you know, might want to use a poll, you might want to get people to annotate. It's the audience research team that comes up with that.
Hi ha una altra qüestió de la Cristina Armengol, que enllaça una mica amb una de les coses que has dit ara, que diu, m'ha semblat molt interessant tot el procés i les possibilitats que ofereix aquest contacte directe amb les famílies, però m'agradaria tenir més informació sobre la fase prèvia al grup de discussió. I aleshores ella pregunta com escolliu la representativitat dels participants. És a dir, els prescriptors comunitaris fan la intermediació i el contacte, però la decisió de les persones que hi participen sobre quina base es pren. Aquesta detecció de persones que d'entrada podrien estar més allunyades del tema, com es fa? Les mètriques tradicionals, diu la Cristina, no sempre permeten detectar aquests buits de manera fiable.
So what we did was, so we have a, we run an annual exit survey of museum visitors with a representative sample. So during the course of the year, we conduct 1,800 exit interviews with people through an external agency. And so from that, we are really clear as to who our visitors are. So we understand in terms of, you know, families versus adults, we understand their ethnicity, disability, et cetera. So we're really clear who our visitors are. And then from that information, we can also see who our visitors aren't. So for example, last year, 16% of our visitors were from a Black and minority ethnic background. We then looked at the official statistics for the UK and for London and for the London boroughs that we are closely, that we're located in, basically. And so from the official, like, census statistics, we can do a comparison and see that while our visitorship was 16% ethnic minority, in the local area, it was far higher. I can't remember the exact figure off the top of my head, but it was far, far higher. So what we realised was we are not representing our local community. By also looking at our local area, we know from these sorts of statistics where people are likely to live with those demographics. So we know, for example, in North Kensington, that people who live in North Kensington are more likely to be from ethnic minorities and lower socioeconomic backgrounds. And so what we've done is to try and contact those people, is to use those community organisations. And we found, through just sort of searching the local area, which community organisations work in those spaces. And quite often they will say that their demographic is people who are from this particular council estate or from this particular background. And so that's why we went to those specific community organisations, because we knew those members had those demographics and those characteristics. So that is how we recruited. Normally we recruit through a sort of a general recruiter, and we always have criteria of who we want. So what we will do with that recruiter is say, you know, these are the characteristics we want. So we might want families with children who are aged 10 to 12. We want them to have, yeah, this level of interest in science perhaps, or what have you, or perhaps they're a museum goer or they're not. And so what that recruiter would then do is ask a screener questionnaire. So when she's contacting people, she will ask these questions, and if people don't match, they don't take part, and if they match, they do take part. So that's how we go about that. I don't know if that was all of the question. I can't remember.
Jo diria que sí, jo diria que sí. Una altra pregunta que fa la Doni Laporte. Podries explicar alguna experiència que consideres que pot il·lustrar l'ús de les entrevistes en profunditat?
Yeah, absolutely. So at the start of the pandemic, literally the first 2 weeks that the UK went into lockdown, we'd planned three face-to-face on-site focus groups with teachers from primary schools. So that's children aged under 12. Obviously, we're in lockdown. We couldn't do that. So what we decided to do was ask the teachers who'd already committed to the focus group, would they mind taking part in an in-depth interview? So we arranged to speak to them at the same time, roughly the same time that the focus group was taking place. We got three members of staff who contacted various teachers. We got certain half-hour time slots. So we called them up and we asked, basically, what we would have asked in the topic guide in the focus group, the questions were super simple, similar. And so we just called them up over the phone and asked them our series of questions. These questions were about what outdoor space do they have at school, and how do they do outdoor learning at school, basically. How do they address topics related to environmental issues with their students, and what support they would want from the museum. So there's sort of three sections. We were lucky, I guess, in that we didn't have any real stimulus material. It was quite early front-end research, so we just wanted to understand their experience at school. And actually, it worked really well as an in-depth one-on-one interview, because really what we were interested in was teachers', I guess, lived experience, their real experience of how did they do it at school. And it was less important for us to sort of have the participants debating the pros and cons, for example, of an issue. We just wanted to understand how they approached it in their school, in their context, and why that was. And it enabled us, by doing the in-depth interview, you can really probe and respond what they're saying. So, for example, if a teacher said, oh, you know what, we don't really do much outdoor learning at my school, we could really probe and say, oh, why is that? Why don't you do much outdoor learning? And we could really respond immediately to and exactly to what they're telling us. And we could have that conversation and really build that in-depth picture, which is harder in an online focus group setting, because you can't get that conversation going because of all the muting and the unmuting, and you can't talk over each other and all that sort of thing. So that's how we did those in-depth interviews. We did 18 interviews with primary school teachers over the course of the 2 weeks. I would say about half an hour, 40 minutes. We paid people the same incentive we would have paid them for the focus group. So it was about £50. We transcribed them all, and then we analysed them and wrote quite an in-depth report. And what we found actually was really nice was that the teachers, we were just going into the lockdown and everything was changing and horrible, but the teachers actually said, and we were worried they'd be too busy to talk to us, to be honest, but they weren't. And actually, they were so grateful, I think, just to have a conversation that was not about the pandemic. We really wanted to know about their experiences prior to. And they actually said they really, really enjoyed it. And that was really nice. And I do think that's something we need to consider with these folk, with any sort of audience research at this really difficult time. There will be some people for whom they're really pleased to have a conversation. They're missing kind of social interaction, and this is a really valuable thing to do. But equally, there are other people for whom they just cannot be dealing with audience research right now. They've got too much else to deal with and to worry about and so on. So I think you have to think really, really carefully is the audience research with this particular audience, is it appropriate right now?
En aquest sentit, la Montse Caballero et pregunta per què vau seleccionar aquesta franja d'edat, de primària 8 a 12 i no una altra.
So we chose families with children aged 8 to 12 because when we looked at the demographic data from our exit survey, that's the age where most families are from that age group, have children in that age group when they visit the museum. So it's kind of like our most popular and our biggest audience segment. So that's why that's our kind of what we're calling a core audience. We recognize they're our biggest audience, and therefore we need to make sure that they are catered for. Having said that, we also recognize that we want to extend that audience. We want to, you know, increase and diversify it. So we've done that in two ways. So one is families with children aged 8 to 12, they tend to be white, they tend to be middle class. So this is why we were focusing for this research on families with the same children age-wise, but from different demographics. So we can hopefully change and extend that audience group. But equally, and I didn't go into it because it wasn't part of this particular case study, but we are also trying to extend that. So lots of families think of us as an 8 to 12 venue and are not so convinced that we have an offer for younger children, and so don't tend to bring their younger children to the museum. So we recognise that, and actually through this project, we are planning to do an offer for younger sort of under eights. And actually that is why we spoke to the primary school teachers. So the primary school teachers we spoke to, our primary schools in the UK are split into three key stages. The first is early years, and they're kind of 4 to 6s. We have key stage 2, which is sorry, Key Stage 1, which is 5 to 7, and Key Stage 2, which is 7 to 11. So we actually spoke to 6 teachers from each of those key stages, which then added up to the 18, if I've done the maths correctly. So we recognise we want to extend that age range through the project.
Jo tinc una pregunta personalment. Tornant al tema dels focus group online, has parlat d'inconvenients i d'avantatges des del punt de vista de la utilització de la metodologia. A mi m'agradaria preguntar-te si heu trobat cap diferència des del punt de vista dels resultats. És a dir, comparant els resultats dels focus groups presencials tradicionals amb els resultats que heu tingut amb aquests online, hi ha cap diferència?
So that's a really interesting question. To an extent, so I think what we found through this case study with the online focus groups here is we did find out a lot of information, and I think we would have found the same amount of information out through the in-depth interviews. I think where my concern is the amount of opportunity you get to probe and really dig deeper into what people are saying. So the focus groups we ran last week with secondary school teachers, I think where I said we talked about 3 different topics in the focus group, I think what we didn't get was like the depth of information. We weren't able to probe and really get a really detailed picture of the situation. And I think the thing that we miss is that kind of sense of similarities and differences between the participants. So in a focus group, so let's talk about meteorites, for example. And we say, what do people think of meteorites? It's really interesting to get some people, oh yeah, I find them really interesting, and I think this, this, and this is interesting. And then someone else says, oh yes, me too, and it's because of this. And then you go, well, does anyone disagree? And someone at the back says, oh no, I hate meteorites. Meteorites are really dull. And it's that debate around it that's really rich in a focus group. And I think that's what I'm trying to get across, is that bit you miss in a virtual focus group because people can't chip in as easily. Say someone is speaking and someone else, you know, you've got a question, someone's speaking, someone else puts their hand up, you know, like this, or literally with their reaction thing. And by the time they finish speaking, if you want to respond to that person, you've got to wait for somebody else to speak. And then maybe somebody else, and then maybe you put it in the chat, and it's, and the conversation moves on, and I've asked another question. And that's, I guess that's what I'm trying to get across. I think that discussion piece is difficult to replicate online in any kind of naturalistic sense. And I should say as well, I recently became a participant in a focus group for a different organization, which was super interesting because I wanted to see it from the other side. And I guess what I felt from that experience myself personally was that if I think about how much I spoke in that hour and a half, it was really minimal. And there were definitely times where I felt like I had something to say, but I couldn't because too many other people were speaking. And by the time it got to me, we'd sort of moved on. I was worried about like dominating the discussion and things like that. And I did feel like, yeah, it was very difficult to respond because if you're responding to somebody, you're potentially stopping someone else from speaking. And it was just a bit challenging. So I think what we found out, I mean, hopefully, as you saw, was super useful and has really helped us think about the project differently. But I do think that that maybe we'd have just got maybe a bit more, like we got good information, we got good quality, in-depth information, but we probably could have got a bit more and maybe more easily through the in-depth interviews, if that makes sense.
Sí, tant i tant. Molt de sentit, molt de sentit. Tenim una altra pregunta de la Marta Cayol, que la fa en anglès i que intentaré traduir-la. Diu que quan la connexió de wifi és deficient, molt deficient en la teva àrea i no tens capacitat, o no pots confiar en ella, teniu alguns materials de suport disponibles a la web del museu?
Yes, and I'm really glad you asked that, because yes, on our website, and I can somehow share the link, we've got a page, we've got an audience research page on the NHM website, and on that, what we have tried to do is share what we've learned through this period in terms of methodologies. So I'm just finding it. And so what I've done is written like a little paper that basically goes into everything that I've just discussed with you about how to run online focus groups during this time period. We've also got other advice on there, for example, how different museums are responding to hands-on exhibits and what we've learned about that, and the different range of ways that people are making their hands-on exhibits COVID safe. So yeah, I can put that link in the chat. And I hope you find it helpful. And also equally, if anybody else has done audience research, I was just going to say, if anyone else we're really keen to share our experiences. We learned so much from other audience researchers who'd done online focus groups before us, and were really kind in terms of, you know, running webinars for us and training sessions and various bits and bobs. We learn from other people. We're learning all the time. Every time my team run an online focus group, we learn more about what works and what doesn't. So really, if anyone has done it or wants to give it a go, and finds out more, I'd love to add to this body of knowledge, and equally happy to follow up with people afterwards as well, because we're all learning and we're all doing our best in really difficult circumstances.
Doncs, moltíssimes gràcies, Marie. He vist que has compartit, ho dic per tothom, has compartit el link amb els estudis al chat, per tant, està a disposició de tothom. De fet, jo penso que a la web de l'Observatori ja hem publicat l'article sobre la conducció o la realització de Focus Online, Focus Group Online, o sigui que, vull dir, que és fàcil de trobar les teves referències. Agraeixo moltíssim la teva participació, ha estat molt, molt i molt interessant. I molta sort en tots els vostres projectes. Moltes gràcies.